Subcommittee will come to order. Bobby, please call the roll.
Chair Broder?
Here.
Representative Beletta is excused. Representatives Gibson?
Gibbons.
Gibbons, I'm sorry.
Gibbons is here. Gibson left.
I'm sorry. Hill?
Here.
Hood?
Here.
Jones?
Here.
Magar?
Here.
McGee?
Here.
Pritchett?
Present.
Rayburn?
Here.
Renouard?
Here.
Richardson?
Here.
Stubbe is excused. Quorum is present, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Bobby. As we begin the meeting, I'd ask everybody to please silence their cell phones and, if you're from 1988, a beeper. Before we get started, there are some new faces on the committee, so I would like to extend a warm welcome to Representative Hill as a new member of the subcommittee. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Certainly. And a warm welcome to me as well as a new member of the committee. Today we are going to be having a presentation by the Agency for Healthcare Administration. We're going to have an update on the recent processes and improvements in our assisted living facilities. And to do that, we have brought in Ms. Molly McKinstry, who is the Deputy Secretary of Health Quality Assurance at ACA. And so we will get right into it. And if you're ready, Ms. McKinstry, you are recognized.
Let's see. Here we go. Thank you very much. I'm Molly McKinstry. I'm the Deputy Secretary for Health Quality Assurance, and we have the regulatory oversight for assisted living facilities. I have a presentation that should be in your packet here. We spoke to the committee last year, and so I wanted to basically focus on an update but hit a few highlights from our presentation last year just to refresh. The agency has hosted over the past, it ended about a year ago, a two-year period where we had an assisted living work group composed of members appointed by the governor to take a look at assisted living regulatory issues and enforcement issues in the state. The work group issued two reports, and the work group activities included multi-location public meetings around the state, significant public comment from all affected parties, providers, advocates, other agencies, organizations that work with individuals who live in assisted living facilities, a very broad spectrum, and put together a series of recommendations that have been shared with the committee in the past, but we'd be happy to share those again. Based upon the recommendations of that work group, in addition to a Senate interim report on the oversight of assisted living facilities, the agency has put together many changes related to assisted living facilities, and we wanted to focus on those with you today. We also received a significant amount of stakeholder comments and suggestions along the way. The majority of our changes relate to enhanced partner communication and coordination, and one of the slides I have for you, or actually two slides, talks about the different regulatory agencies involved in assisted living facilities. So I think it's important to understand the diversity of individuals that are in the facilities and those organizations that represent them. But we have worked hard to improve our communication and coordination with those agencies. Some of the early issues that we identified had to do with partner agencies that had concerns about assisted living facilities that didn't necessarily know how to bring those to our attention from a regulatory perspective. So we've worked hard to put a variety of systems in place, including meetings. We actually participate in many of the training programs, for example, for Department of Children and Family staff, for Attorney General staff, for Ombudsman staff, to talk about the role of the agency, the responsibility of assisted living facilities, and when to report problems to us as well. We've also done a significant amount of consumer outreach. We've made significant enhancements to our Florida Health Finder website and have actually recently released an assisted living portal. So anybody can go to our website, click on our assisted living portal, and see all the information that the agency has about assisted living facilities. That includes how to look up an individual facility, a consumer guide that helps families know what questions to ask and what to look for in an assisted living facility, as well as many other resources that are available about the record of that facility. We even have the citations that we cited them for and the legal sanctions that have been imposed as well. We've also developed an assisted living enforcement team. This has been in place for about 2 years now. And what we did is we pulled some of our most seasoned inspection staff for assisted living facilities together into a team. They're located around the state, so they're actually embedded into our field offices, but they function under a common control, so they're involved in some of the high-profile assisted living cases. A little closer. They're involved in some of the high-profile cases, some of our serious complaint issues, and in training our staff and partnering with our field office staff to work towards consistency in the process. We've done some revisions to our survey process, and we've enhanced our training and survey oversight. Just to give a little bit of background, assisted living facilities, most of you are familiar with them. They provide full-time living arrangements to individuals in a less restrictive setting, more home-like setting. And many people find them as a good long-term care residential alternative, hopefully a place that they can maintain where they need a little bit of assistance but aren't really ready for a nursing home. They do have a significant variety in terms of what assisted living facilities look like and the services and individuals they serve. They can be apartments. They can be, more like a multi-room apartment for an individual. They may have shared rooms for individuals. And there is significant diversity in the clients that they serve. I think traditionally people think of assisted living facilities as serving the elderly, but we actually have about a third of our assisted living facilities in the state that serve individuals with mental illness. So there's a huge diversity in the clients served, including their age and their medical needs as well. We also have significant diversity in the size. About half the assisted living facilities in the state are 6 beds or less, and that's out of 3,000 facilities, where we have others where about 10% are 100 beds or more. So there's dramatic differences between those facilities. The goals are, though, that they serve those clients in the least restrictive setting possible and help individuals maintain their independence as long as possible. The regulations are written for assisted living facilities to allow as much flexibility to allow people to age in place as well. Within the assisted living licensure type, we have a standard license. All of the facilities have to have a standard license, and that basically provides assistance with activities of daily living, which would include bathing, dressing, things like that. And they staff can assist with the self-administration of medications. So if a resident needs some assistance in taking their medications, that can be done in a standard facility. They would also be responsible for things like meals and activities and things like that. Then we have 3 specialty types, and not all facilities have a specialty, but some of them do. We have limited mental health, and this is where clients that are receiving federal supplementation through the optional state supplementation program, or they're on Social Security disability. If they're in either of those 2 programs because of a mental illness, then they need to be in a facility that's licensed as a limited mental health facility if that facility has 2 or more of those clients. There's also the extended congregate care license. This is going to be our highest acuity, so those individuals with more nursing needs can be in an extended congregate care. Nurses can perform a wide array of services, and individuals can stay a little longer in this setting as their health declines. And then we have the limited nursing services, and this allows some nursing services to occur, but not quite as robust as what can occur in an extended congregate care. In each of these specialty licenses, staff have to have a little additional training as well. This is some statistics about our assisted living facilities. As I mentioned, we have just over 3,000 in the state, over 86,000 beds, which actually I believe that now has passed our nursing home beds. We have about 83,000 nursing home beds. We've had a lot of growth in assisted living facilities over the last 10 years, primarily between 2003 and 2008. It's been pretty steady for the last 5 years. But this has clearly become an alternative for individuals residing in long-term care facilities, especially we're not seeing the originally expected nursing home growth. As you can see, about a third of the facilities have the limited mental health license. Only about 276 have the extended congregate care, which is that more medically complex, and then about a third have the limited nursing services. The next 2 slides show you the different state agencies that are involved in some way in assisted living oversight. So we have our agency for healthcare administration is the licensing agency, and we also have the Medicaid program. We do pay for some care in assisted living facilities. The Department of Children and Families does adult protective investigations. They also facilitate mental health services, and they administer one of the Medicaid waivers. Then we have the Agency for Persons with Disabilities. So some individuals in assisted living facilities are actually clients with developmental disabilities from the agency there. The Attorney General is involved. Their Medicaid Fraud Control Unit is involved in patient abuse, neglect, exploitation, or Medicaid issues. And they're also involved in what's called an Operation Spot Check. And this is an activity where the Attorney General facilitates pulling together all these different partner agencies, and we go in together and each look at our regulatory roles together. This is not a frequent event, but it does happen from time to time, and provides an opportunity to look at all areas of regulatory concern. That's usually based upon, more recently, based upon concerns that might be at a facility. The Health Department is involved in health and sanitation. The Department of Elder Affairs has the rule writing oversight for assisted living facilities, and of course we implement that rule as our licensing. And they also administer the CARES program, the Comprehensive Assessment Program for Long-Term Care Services, which is a requirement for Medicaid as well. They have the Long-Term Care Ombudsman, the State Public Guardianship Office, training, certification, waivers. And then, of course, we have the local authorities, and they have the basically the building oversight. So they're looking at the fire, life safety, the zoning, and building. So there's a lot of different parties involved in this. And when I mentioned early on, one of the significant areas of outreach we've done is to coordinate with these partners. These are the folks I'm talking about. This is a lot of different people that are in those facilities, and if they're seeing issues of concern, we need to make sure that they know to let us know so we can take a look if it's a regulatory issue for the license. Other outreach that we've done involves providers and consumers. We now do joint training of our assisted living administrators, providers, and our survey staff. This is something we've done for about 10 years with nursing homes, and we've expanded it to include assisted living facilities for the last 2 years. That's been a great opportunity. We go around the state, we do multiple sites, and we talk to everybody together, the regulators and the providers in one room, about regulatory updates, top deficiencies, concerns, quality improvement activities, and things like that. So that's been a great outreach. I mentioned the Florida Health Finder. We've got the assisted living portal. We now also have Medicaid information on that page. So if you look up an assisted living facility, you can see what Medicaid programs they participate in. We have a smartphone app for our assisted living, for our Florida Health Finder in general. So you can look up facilities through your smartphone. And we do have the sanctions and emergency actions against all of our providers, not just assisted living facilities, but everything we regulate. We're also doing monthly press releases, and this is not just about assisted living either. This is for all the providers we regulate and those providers that are terminated from the Medicaid program. We do a monthly press release to raise awareness about the actions we're taking. And that's basically to let the public know that there are issues that are addressed, and this is our way of letting folks know that these facilities no longer participate. And then we do collaborative training, as I mentioned, with other agencies and departments. We also have, internally, we have a weekly facility action meetings between Medicaid and licensure. So if we have concerns on one side or the other, we're sharing that information. We have conducted several joint inspections with our Medicaid Program Integrity Office. So if there's a concern on the Medicaid side that may end up being a licensure issue, we're there together. We have access to systems and data with our partner agencies. We now have access to the Department of Elder Affairs. They share their ombudsman information and complaints with us, and we share with them. And we also interface with the Department of Children and Families Abuse information, so we can more readily look up concerns they've had before we go and do an inspection in an assisted living or any regulated facility.
And Ms. McKinstry, if I could, we've covered a lot of ground on the partnership so far. I just wanted to check in and see if anybody had any questions on what we've heard so far. It's all partnership stuff before we go into regulation. Okay, great.
Okay.
Please continue. Yes, Representative Magar.
On the rule development for assisted living, adult family care, home, adult care, hospice, is that rule development for the facility or for the inspection?
That
You're
would
recognized.
Be, oh, thank you. That would be the rules to implement the licensing statutes. So the statutes lay out the basic licensure program, and then there's rule authority to add details in those rules. So it would relate to the agency licensing the facility.
Okay. A follow-up question?
Yes. On the different types of license, can one facility have more than one license?
You recognize?
Yes, and we do have some facilities that have a limited mental health and a limited nursing service. It may not make sense to have limited nursing and extended congregate care because one kind of trumps the other, but we do have some facilities that have the limited mental health and either the ECC or nursing.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Any other questions?
Just one.
Representative Renouard?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually on slide 6, you've got as far as the non-private beds, you have the OSS number of beds. That's the office. What does that stand for?
You recognize?
Pardon our abbreviations. That's the optional state supplementation. And I'm glad you asked that question because what this really signifies is there are certain beds that are exempt from paying a licensure fee. Those beds that are designated to serve individuals on the optional state supplementation program, that is a small federal stipend that I believe is about $700 a month that is paid to individuals for care. So the facilities that are accepting those OSS clients are typically serving a more indigent population. Those beds are exempt from licensure fees. So licensure fees are paid for the private pay beds, but not the OSS beds. Now, an assisted living facility has a basic licensure fee that everybody pays, but you also pay a per bed fee. And I don't want to I don't want the mistake to make the mistake that the private pay means that 71,000 people in assisted living facilities are paying for their own care. It doesn't mean that there's private pay to pay for their care. They may be on Medicaid, they may be on some other program, but if they're on OSS, those beds are exempt from the fee.
Any other questions? Seeing none, please continue, Ms. McKinstry.
Thank you. Okay. We've hit awareness quite a bit. Let me mention one thing on long-term care managed care. The agency is in the process now of rolling out long-term care Medicaid managed care around the state. The assisted living services in the Medicaid program, many of them fall under long-term care managed care. There are some that do not and will be rolled into the medical assistance managed care that we'll be rolling out next year. But what we've made a point of here is to make sure that we're in touch with managed care plans about assisted living facilities and nursing homes and other providers that we regulate. And when we have issues with an assisted living facility and we have an extreme action such as a termination or a moratorium, we do share that with the plan so that they can make sure that they're aware of that for the clients that they serve. So that's been an extra piece of coordination there. Our inspections of assisted living facilities, we do biennial inspections, which means every 2 years we're doing a full licensure survey. In addition to that, we have a complaint investigations, and we do have some monitoring visits based upon those specialty licenses. So we do, if you have an extended congregate care, those 276 facilities, we're also in there each quarter looking at the extended congregate care clients. We do twice a year monitoring for the limited nursing services facilities. And our inspection process is basically focused on looking at compliance issues. If we're doing a routine survey, we actually revised our process to focus more on resident outcomes. We do some pre-survey work where we look at the violations that have been cited before. We look at the ombudsman concerns, the Department of Children and Families abuse registry concerns. If we have a complaint, we're going to focus in on the nature of the complaint and then pull a couple other residents that may have similar issues so that we're fully investigating the allegations. We also have adverse incident reports that are reported to the agency that are useful in our review prior to going on site. And, again, I mentioned the abuse reports and ombudsman reports. The enforcement team that I mentioned to you earlier is made up of 13 surveyors. They do function as a support to our local survey staff, but they are physically located out there and report up centrally. I've kind of covered this, but they are focusing on our high priority complaints. They also help do a lot of outreach with our other state agencies. So they are involved in contacting law enforcement and doing presentations with other agencies as well. And we do some off-hour and weekend inspections in assisted living facilities. We don't just show up between 8 and 5, especially if the concern has to do with evening meals or some kind of weekend staffing. Our complaint will occur when those allegations are made. They also do quality assurance reviews of our surveys. We've enhanced our training. We now have a 16-week comprehensive orientation program. We focus on the regulations, how to identify violations, how to properly document them, and then we do have field experience with a mentor or preceptor assigned to our new staff as well. We've also implemented an ALF core training program. It is there is a core training requirement for nursing home administrators. They have to go through a certain course and pass a certain test. So we mimic a lot of those same requirements for our staff so that they're aware of those. And then we also do validation surveys where if we have, we do a sample of some of our inspections where we send our team into behind our initial staff to make sure that they agree with the findings. I mentioned we revised our survey process. We focus on basically the residents and the outcomes. We concentrate on interviews with residents and family members and staff, and, of course, observations that we make, as well as our preliminary review of information before we go in. This has improved the consistency of our violations. Another thing we've done with our violations is we have the regulatory standards in the statute and rule, and we've crossed those to what we call deficiency tags. And we did an exercise about 3 years ago where we collapsed some of those tags so that there were a fewer number of tags, because what we found sometimes is you'd have one problem and you'd end up with three tags because it fit in three different areas. And so we collapsed some of those to eliminate the duplication of citations. So that has also led to greater consistency in our citations as well. We also have implemented an abbreviated survey process, which is in statute, and that basically allows a more abbreviated survey for a facility with a better regulatory history. We look back at the last 4 years of their performance, and we would look for consistent ownership. We'd look for an excellent survey history. We'd look for a no substantiated complaints with the agency or the ombudsman program, and they would be eligible for that abbreviated survey. Now, if we start an abbreviated survey and we find problems, we will expand it to a full survey, and that has happened in some cases. So we are still in there to see enough to know if there are concerns. We need to expand that review. But this new process does focus on resident feedback and outcomes, rather than a checklist of going through the whole statute. When we do find problems in an assisted living facility, we would cite deficiencies and, this is the abbreviated survey criteria. I won't go over the details here, but these are the types of criteria we'd look at to determine if you get the abbreviated survey. Here we go. When we do our surveys in facilities, we do cite deficiencies. This chart shows you how many inspections we've done. So although our biennial surveys are once every 2 years, we're actually out in assisted living facilities on average more than twice a year. And that's because we're doing complaint investigations. If we find violations, we're going back to determine if they're corrected. So there are really multiple opportunities to get into the facilities. So of the 6,200 facility visits that we made this last fiscal year, 2,311 of those visits resulted in deficiencies that were cited. When we cite a deficiency, we typically classify it. We give it a class 1, 2, 3, or 4, and 1 is going to be the most serious. So 1 is a situation where there's a imminent risk to health, safety, and welfare, a serious risk, something that needs to be attended to immediately. 2 is going to be where there is some risk, but it's not as imminent as a 1. 3 is going to be, and 4 is more of a paperwork problem. So you can see our total violations for the last year were about 8,000. And some of the shrinking of the violations here, I believe, is because we've collapsed some of those tags. So it doesn't mean that we're not finding issues. It's just that some of them are being grouped differently. And we also believe that a lot of the outreach we've done over the last 2 years is leading to better compliance. We'll talk about some of the actions we've taken against facilities for some of these violations, including non-renewal of licenses and termination from the program. But hopefully this is a representation of better compliance as well. In addition to the deficiencies, if we find very serious problems, we can take an emergency action. When we find deficiencies, we do impose fines for some of those, and I'll talk about that, but typically when we issue a sanction, the provider is entitled to due process before that sanction is imposed. The only exception to that is an emergency action. So if we find something so egregious that it puts people at serious risk, we can impose a moratorium, which means they're banned from accepting any new residents, or we can suspend the license. And that is something that we use rarely. We have a very high legal threshold before we can impose that, but it is available, and we'll show you some statistics on that in a minute. And then those sanctions that are entitled to due process, the fines I mentioned for the deficiencies, there is a conditional license that can be issued if you fail to correct your violations before your license has to be renewed. And then there's also action to deny a license that can happen at renewal or an initial application or seek revocation. Now, in addition to these sanctions, we do put a note about facilities that close during litigation. We have some facilities that that may have a revocation or denial action pending that instead of letting it go all the way through to a final order, they decide to close. And we do we include those in our statistics because we believe those are facilities that have closed due to the regulatory pressure. Another change we made over the past few years is to centralize our evaluation of sanctions. So the field offices conduct the visits. Is issued, or if there's a pending action, it may lead to denial of a renewal. And then I mentioned the monthly press releases. The sanctions, I mentioned that they do have an opportunity to challenge. There are actions that the action itself is pending during litigation, and that's just basically saying the fine wouldn't be due while the litigation was ongoing or the conditional license, et cetera. And then once a final order is issued, there is a further challenge that can occur to the District Court of Appeal. Then the court can enjoin the agency from imposing that action. So it's rare that this happens, but if we have, for example, a denial that's appealed to a District Court of Appeal, the District Court of Appeal may ask us to cease our denial while they're waiting on their decision. This is our fine structure. As you can see, is a larger range for the more serious violations. And then the statute spells out how we determine where in the range the fines fall. So it's based on the gravity of the violation, actions taken to correct, previous violations, the financial benefit of committing the violation, and the license capacity. So that gives there's some latitude in determining that. And this is something that's being that's been discussed over the past few years, is instead of having the flexibility to determine where in the fine range the fines fall, that perhaps a prescribed amount be considered. That may be something you'd like to consider as well. These are assisted living fines over the last 6 years here. Now, the fines, remember that they go through the litigation process, so they don't always represent inspections that occurred during that year. Okay? Yes.
Thank you, and I know we've covered a lot of ground on regulatory environment and fines and whatnot. If you could just explain a little bit about why it seemed to jump so dramatically from 10-11 to 11-12.
Sure. Well, if you'll remember the slide that had the number of citations on it, that were about, I think, 14,000. Let me look real quick at that. Sorry, I don't have that one right for me. And I mentioned the regulatory groupings and also the compliance issues. So these fines are going to be based upon the deficiencies that we've cited. And there is going to be some lag time in that. So basically, this would be reflective of the deficiencies. Again, if there has been, we've seen a little drop-off from last year, and that could be because of fewer citations being cited, either because of collapsing the deficiencies or better compliance.
Okay, but it's more than doubled in 1 year, so I just wanted to make sure that it was, it seemed like the agency had a handle on why it was. It seemed like it was relatively stable for a long time, and then it's jumped up to a new level.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Basically, I would just say that that's going to be reflective of our cases. I mean, there definitely have been